This weekend starts right after this. Managing your 401k is hard. Bloom isn't. See what you could be doing to make your 401k better by getting a free analysis at bloom401k.com/deal. That's Bloom with three O's, 401k.com/deal.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Drones for drugs. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Border Patrol agents are trying to figure out how they stop Mexican drug cartels from airlifting drugs into the U.S. with high-tech drones.
The coffee purists won't like this story. Even the best baristas say coffee machines have their perks. Is this the end of the pour-over?
In a deep freeze, like much of the country is experiencing, the list of items you should not leave in your car, like musical instruments and beer.
And perhaps the worst job in tech, the people responsible for removing some of the horrible stuff from places like Facebook.
There is a lot of terrible stuff on the internet that most of us don't see at all. They are viewing incredibly violent material, everything from beheadings by terror groups to sexual exploitation of children, violence against animals. You really do see the underbelly of what humans are capable of.
Wall Street Journal reporter Lauren Weber on staring at human depravity all day. She's here in about 25 minutes. Border Patrol agents are increasingly worried about the threat from drones flown by drug cartels after agents spotted more than a dozen drones suspected of carrying drugs across one section of the U.S.-Mexico border in just a four-day period back in November. Incredible story from Stephen Dynan, political editor at The Washington Times, who's been covering border issues for years. Stephen, what have you uncovered?
Part of the issue is we have no clue, absolutely no clue about the amount of this traffic going back and forth. And I got a report from some agents that they had over a four-day period in one station, so a Border Patrol station in California, had detected 13 different drones flying back and forth in this one four-day period. And it turns out it's basically over about a three-hour period of those 4 days, 13 drones. And the agent said, look, we got lucky. We spotted these guys. We have no clue how many more are out there. It could be that we got all 13 of them. Yeah. Much more likely that there are hundreds of these flights going on and we aren't seeing them. And imagine all the drugs that they are carrying.
Jeez. All right. So I envision these drones just like hoisting some sort of package full of drugs that goes, over some fence or wall or any kind of border. And what, a delivery person picks it up?
Yeah, that's pretty much the setup. And now we say drones, and a lot of your listeners may be thinking of the sort of things they see as they're in the backyard, and something a hobbyist drone comes buzzing over or something. And these are basically professional level drones that the cartels are flying. They're not the $500 things; they're the $5,000 things, and they can carry loads of up to about 10 to 15 pounds, which makes them perfect for hard drugs. They're not carrying a big bale of marijuana, but they are carrying heroin, and they're carrying methamphetamine, and the hard, high-dollar hard drugs, where that 10 pounds is worth $50,000 over here. So if they can fly that drone back and forth, and they pay, according to one case that I've tracked, they paid a guy $1,000 for every pickup. They were using a $5,000 drone. If they can get one or two loads over, even if they lose the drone in the second one, they've still ended up ahead in terms of the value and the money. So it's really valuable for the cartels. And as you described it, that's exactly right. They'll fly the drone over. They have a pickup arranged. Sometimes it's literally in a neighborhood where the drone comes down in one of these American neighborhoods just north of the border. Wow. North of the border fence, and sometimes sort of in these neighborhoods where the Border Patrol doesn't necessarily regularly patrol, and sure enough, there's somebody there who does the pickup, and usually it's a middle guy, just some guy who's paid $1,000 to make the pickup and then deliver the drugs to some nameless guy in a parking lot somewhere else that he knew. He knew the times he was supposed to be for the pickup and the times he was supposed to drop off with a nameless distributor in the parking lot, and that's exactly how it goes down.
We're speaking with Stephen Dinan, political editor at The Washington Times. Since they're being delivered in some neighborhood, it seems, that eliminates the possibility of shooting these things down. But what about early on when they're crossing some of that really rough landscape?
So and this is exactly the question. This is why I'd mentioned the ultralights at the beginning, because for years I've sort of been trying to figure out what Border Patrol policy is. And the fact is, it turns out there isn't a policy. The Border Patrol doesn't have the technology to detect drones, and they certainly don't have a policy for how to interdict them, other than, hey, if we can catch it while it's on the ground, then we're able to seize it. But when I was covering the ultralight issue years ago, there was a sheriff in southern Arizona who was wondering, hey, you know, why can't my deputies shoot this down? You know, why can't the Border Patrol? Why don't they have, this is essentially the equivalent of an invading air force. Why can't we just shoot these things down if we know they are coming across? And the official word back was, well, first of all, we don't have that policy. And second of all, there are all sorts of concerns about shooting down something where there's a man or a woman, a pilot, sitting in the ultralight. The drone is a little more iffy of a situation, right? It's a piece of mechanical equipment. There is no pilot there flying it. Obviously, over an urban area, as you said, there's a danger that it'll fall and fall out of the sky and do damage. But over a rural area, there are agents who say, "Yeah, we think we could bring them down with a suitable weapon if that were our policy and we were provided with the suitable weapon." But the Border Patrol and Customs and Border Protection, the agency that oversees them, simply doesn't have that policy, much less the ability to detect them in any sort of sense. Having said that, the Defense Department, airports, other critical infrastructure are all very interested in this threat, as you can imagine. With drones growing, there some of the reports of what ISIS has done with drones have the Defense Department, the Pentagon, the FBI, basically the counterterrorism officials, very worried about the possibility of IEDs and grenades being dropped from a drone here in the U.S. by terrorists. Obviously, the cartels could conceivably do the same sort of thing. So the Defense Department's made a lot of progress in developing technology with private companies, developing technology. I spoke with one. They say that they have the ability not only to detect, but also to take control using the radio frequency signals to take control of a drone in the sky. And they say that that technology is easily transferable to the border if Homeland Security wants to go that route and come up with that policy.
Stephen Dinan, political editor at The Washington Times. That's some story. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and defense. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Thanks for being with us. Seasonal affective disorder, known as the winter blues, is a form of depression that affects nearly 10 million people every single year. And while doctors may not know exactly what causes SAD, that doesn't stop it from impacting the lives of millions. Insight from Dr. John Huber, clinical forensic psychologist and chairman of a nonprofit called Mainstream Mental Health. He's in the Dallas area. Doctor, how do you see this?
After the holidays, this time of year is particularly disturbing because the cold and bad weather in general kind of keeps us isolated, whereas before, as we moved into the holiday season, we had all these social events that kind of kept us going even though the weather was bad. Now we don't for the next couple of months, and this is actually when we start seeing a big upswing in attempted suicides and things like that. So the cold weather is very impactful, definitely.
Wow. All right, so on a basic level, how do you perhaps avoid seasonal affective disorder or manage it?
Well, with seasonal affective disorder, one of the best ways to deal with that is to find a way to get your serotonin to be increased without the sunlight. And one of the easiest ways to do that is exercise. However, it's cold, so unless you have a gym in your house or belong to a gym, it's very difficult to do that. So a lot of individuals do things like yoga that don't take a lot of space. You can move the coffee table out of the way, and that helps a lot. Another way is, you know, but you have to weigh this against the possible, you know, issues with skin cancer, are tanning beds and going to a tanning bed this time. I have an aunt who lives up in the mountains in Colorado, and she has gone to a tanning bed since I've met her in the 70s, and she complains that if she doesn't go, she gets depressed. And there's actual science behind that. So,
you know, to your point earlier about the cold weather keeping people indoors and perhaps isolating us, leading to an increased number of suicides, does that mean that in perhaps warm weather states or better weather states that don't experience, say, you know, several days in a row of sub-freezing, that there are fewer suicides?
You know, it's not completely that conclusive because of the shortened days. Those sunny states like Florida that are used to really intense, long days of sunshine, you cut those back and you're only getting a portion of that, it can be just as impactful.
Wow. We're speaking with Dr. John Huber, clinical forensic psychologist, also chairman of a nonprofit called Mainstream Mental Health. We're talking about seasonal affective disorder, especially now with this extreme cold that much of the country is experiencing. What else on this front in terms of maybe even noticing some signs that you could be in trouble here?
Well, one of the things that we often neglect also this time of year is drinking lots of clear fluids, in particular water. And I say that now when you ask me about those signs, because one of the things that happens when you start getting dehydrated is your memory starts slipping. And, you know, you start having tip of the tongue syndrome where you have that word and you know it, you just can't pull it out of your memory. Wow. Well, when you start having subtle memory problems, it oftentimes can be difficult to remember or to realize that you're falling into that depression. So you want to stay hydrated as well as try to stay as active as possible without getting frostbite.
Can seasonal affective disorder come and go sort of like a cold snap, like where it might be, you know, 20 degrees for 6 days in a row, then warm up to the 40s and the sun comes out and it feels great, and then you get another cold snap? Can that situation waver like that?
I haven't seen any documents, you know, that indicate that that is something that, but everybody as an individual, you know, has their own tolerances. So it may be possible within an individual to have that. However, I don't have the research that supports that conclusively.
You mentioned too that if you have to be indoors, what, do some stuff to kind of organize,
keep the blood
right?
Flowing. Yeah, keep the blood flowing. Do some yoga, do some sit-ups, do some push-ups. Start your day with a really good stretch, you know, get out on the floor and work on your adductors and abductors and do some leg lifts, get the blood flowing. And, you know, I used to have a coach used to say, you know, it doesn't matter how you're feeling, get up, get dressed, and get moving.
Thanks, John. Dr. John Huber, clinical forensic psychologist, also chairman of Mainstream Mental Health. It is 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. When the new Pittsburgh International Airport terminal opened 25 years ago, it was seen as the airport of the future. Planes could taxi all the way around the gate areas with no alley or buildings to slow arrivals and departures. It had a shopping mall, an advanced baggage system, and it had a half-mile train ride to gates. Now, Wall Street Journal travel writer Scott McCartney says the airport is a symbol of how much air travel has changed. Scott, explain.
The whole travel business has changed so much. Pittsburgh was the airport. The terminals were built 25 years ago, and it was supposed to be the airport of the future. And things have changed so much, it's essentially obsolete. So it had a huge check-in area, but nobody checks in anymore at a counter in front of a person. You check in with your phone, or you use a kiosk and self-tag your bags, or you just bypass the whole thing. It had a small area for security screening because it was built pre-9/11. And because of structural obstacles with the building, poor design to be able to expand that, they can't expand that. So they have lines stretching out the door and into the garage. The airport itself, it was built for connecting passengers and not local passengers. There's not even a good way to depart when you arrive on an international flight. The assumption was everybody would be going back around to gates to make a connection. And so they have to sort of rebuild the whole thing to create an airport that's right for Pittsburgh now.
Wow. And so that will involve what? Total redesign? Gobs of money, I presume?
Well, yeah, more than $1 billion. Certainly not cheap. Essentially, there are two buildings, what they call the landside building, which is everything before security, including the security screening area, and then the airside, which is where the gates are and the retail and all that kind of stuff. And they're separate today, linked by a half-mile train. The train itself is a giant inhibitor. It costs $4 or $5 million a year to operate and maintain. It's basically a time waste, and it turns out to be really inconvenient. So what they're going to do is knock down the existing landside building, build a new one right up against the gate area. They'll lose 24 gates in the process, but they don't really need those, and they can create one building, which becomes much more convenient for getting in and out.
Wow. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal travel columnist Scott McCartney about his piece entitled What to Do When Your Airport is Too Big. We're discussing the problem at Pittsburgh. I would imagine Pittsburgh's not alone in this.
No, there are multiple things going on, but there are a lot of medium-sized airports around the country that were built at a different time and built in some cases for hub airline operations that no longer exist. Voters in Kansas City just recently approved a $1 billion project there to take those terminals, which are actually built, I believe, in the 70s, long before there was any kind of security screening, really, for airline travel. And they're going to take three circular buildings and create one much more convenient building out of that.
Thanks, Scott. That is Wall Street Journal travel columnist Scott McCartney. Reminder, by the way, that we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter with the username @ThisMorningShow. You can follow me directly on Twitter with the username @GordonDeal. It is 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Support for This Morning with Gordon Deal comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. With Rocket Mortgage, you can apply simply and understand fully so you can mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/Gordon. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org number 3030. Thanks for spending some time with us. First full weekend of January. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka coming up this half hour. What not to do if you get a big promotion. Also, coffee baristas say some coffee machines do have their perks and things you should not leave in your car when it's freezing outside. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. It might be argued that one of the least desirable jobs in tech is to watch all the seedy stuff and flag it. Social media giants hire scores of contractors to hunt for pornography, racism, and violence in a torrent of posts and videos. More from this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
We all want to see social networks cleared of inappropriate content, but you ever stop to wonder who might be responsible for doing that? Lauren Weber of the Wall Street Journal has written an article entitled "The Worst Job in Tech, Keeping Facebook Clean." Lauren, who is responsible for the cleanup?
Well, there's a whole category of workers that's basically arisen because of the internet called content moderators or content reviewers. And these are people who are reviewing usually posts or videos or user-generated content that has been flagged by other users as potentially inappropriate.
Were these people trained to do this job, or how were they trained?
It's a very difficult job, both emotionally, because sometimes people are viewing very disturbing material, and also because a lot of it requires judgment calls. You know, it's not a simple thing to identify what is hate speech and what's not. you know, or what violates the terms of service of a website, a social media site, and what doesn't. So it does require training. From what we found, I wrote this story with a colleague, and we spoke to about 24 content moderators. Some received weeks of training, some received a few hours of training, but in the end, we came away feeling that, you know, as I said, this is a very difficult job to do, both emotionally and it's very intellectually challenging.
What kinds of stuff are the Facebook employees seeing?
It's not just Facebook. It's also Twitter, YouTube, you know, any site where people are posting their own content, or, you know, groups or others that want to send a message out there are posting content. For example, ISIS tends to be very active on social media sites. There is a lot of terrible stuff on the internet that most of us don't see at all, thanks to the work of content moderators. But when we spoke to people doing the work, they are viewing incredibly violent material, everything from beheadings by terror groups to sexual exploitation of children, violence against animals. Basically, you know, you really do see the underbelly of what humans are capable of, and it's most of us don't get exposed to that very often.
We're speaking with Lauren Weber of the Wall Street Journal. Lauren, when they see something disturbing, what happens next?
There are a few different things that can happen. When content moderators see something that explicitly and clearly violates the terms of service of the website that they're working for, sometimes they disable a user's account. Sometimes they simply remove that material but keep the website up. If it's material that clearly shows some kind of criminal activity going on, all of the major sites have agreements with law enforcement and organizations like the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, where they will report that and put it into the appropriate hands of the appropriate agency or government group that can deal with it.
I think a lot of people were under the assumption that artificial intelligence or algorithms was taking care of this and not so much human beings, but there's no way to take the human out of it.
You're absolutely right. And most of the comments that I've gotten or emails that I've gotten from readers are basically saying, like, I'm sure they can figure this out, you know, how to automate this so that people don't have to do this kind of very difficult work. But the technology is just not there yet, and it probably won't be for a long time. For example, the AI, you know, artificial intelligence, can in many cases identify nudity, you know, because we look for certain flesh tones, or, you know, there are certain ways that you can train a computer to identify that and take that material off before a human being has to look at it. But it's not so clear. You know, Facebook got in big trouble when a moderator took down a very famous photo from the Vietnam War of a naked girl who had been exposed to napalm. I believe that photo won a Pulitzer Prize. They got in big trouble because somebody looked at it, said, well, that violates the terms of service. We don't have pictures of naked children on the website, and took it down. So, you know, there are these ambiguous cases where, you know, you don't necessarily, you do need some human judgment. And that's for nudity, which, again, a computer can in many cases be trained to identify. When you talk about something like hate speech, it's much harder. There's a lot more ambiguity. It's hard to figure out what the intent is of someone, you know, using a term or a phrase that would be considered abhorrent in many circumstances, but perhaps in other circumstances is not. There's a lot of gray area.
Thanks, Lauren. It's Wall Street Journal reporter Lauren Weber with this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka. It is 20 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. Hoda Kotb this past week was named as the new co-anchor of NBC's Today, joining Savannah Guthrie. The 53-year-old steps into the vacancy left by Matt Lauer, who was fired in late November amid allegations of sexual harassment in the workplace. It's a huge promotion. How do you handle something like that? Not just in media and television, but in other professions. Here's MarketWatch reporter Jacob Passy. Jacob, give us guidance.
So I was looking at basically, you know, the pitfalls to avoid when you've gotten a promotion or you know, have changed your role within a company, just because that can be a pretty dicey time for an employee. You know, you can ruffle feathers very easily. There are going to be some hurt feelings among folks who were not promoted. And as we've seen from the past, you know, with what Ann Curry went through, for instance, at the Today Show, you know, it's not always so easy transitioning into a high-profile job. So there are definitely things you need to keep in mind if you go through this. It's something that everyone, I think, goes through at some point in their career. So, yeah, you don't have to be famous to deal with these issues.
Yeah. All right. So as you point out, too, kind of one of your first points here is basically don't step on the backs all of a sudden of the people you used to work with, right? Like, don't get so uppity or talk to only the higher ups.
Right. Yeah. You don't want it to let it get to your head. You know, the support staff at any organization are so critical to you getting your work done effectively, and you don't want to develop kind of a complex when you get a promotion. You know, keep in mind that those support staff, the secretaries, the assistants, everyone, they're very critical in getting the day-to-day work done. And you know, they're not necessarily enjoying the promotion that you've just gotten. Yeah. So
you said too, find out how you'll be judged in your new role, because that definition may have changed perhaps from the person you're replacing.
Exactly. Yeah, you want to have a clear sense of what the expectations are. You know, whenever there's a shakeup internally within an organization, the job requirements and job expectations may have changed as well. You know, in getting your promotion, they may be, you know, combining two roles within one position. So you know, you don't want to go in thinking, oh well, this is what the person who was in this job before did, so that's exactly what I have to do. You know, every time there's a change, there could be a change in expectations. So it's good to just get that laid out from the beginning. Mm.
You said too, don't try to change too much.
Yeah, you know, the folks I talk with talked about how people who've received promotions can get a bit of a superhero complex. You know, they can feel like that they are capable of solving all of the problems within the organization now that they've been promoted. And that's not always the case. There might be legacy issues at play. You don't want to also step on too many people's toes, you know. But you don't want to keep your head down either, you know. Making yourself known and making yourself present is important, but don't get ahead of yourself and think that you alone can change a whole organization overnight. Because also, you know, changing too much can ruffle just as many feathers as being inactive could.
Thanks, Jacob. Market Watch reporter Jacob Passy. It is 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today. Glad you could spend some time with us. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The best place to start or grow your business is at michiganbusiness.org. Contact them today. The practice of making coffee by the cup, known as a pour-over, has been an essential skill for gourmet baristas for nearly a decade. The purposefully slow, personal nature of the ritual is an icon of the artisanal movement. Now, uttering words like efficiency and consistency, some coffee shops are embracing the perks of machines. Wall Street Journal reporter Julie Jargon spotted the trend. Julie, what have you found?
What I found was a little bit surprising and a bit ironic. Some of the artisan craft kind of coffee shops that have sprung up over the recent years and have been specializing in the handmade pour-over coffee, kind of this coffee poured by the cup, basically, are going back to coffee that is brewed in large batches, like big batch brewers, the type that you see at gas stations, the kind of the big coffee urns that you see sitting out. Mm-hmm. And they're doing it for a variety of reasons, including the fact that these machines can make coffee more quickly, more efficiently, and serve more customers faster, because it takes a few minutes to do a handmade pour-over, and if you've got a line of several people, it can keep people waiting a long time. So people in this fast-paced day and age apparently don't want to wait around so much anymore for their coffee to be made by hand. And so coffee shops are kind of waking up to that.
Tell me about these new machines then.
So there's a company out of Indiana, actually, that makes something called the Mod Bar, which is kind of a fancy machine where the baristas can program it to make a pour-over the way they would make it by hand. They can turn all these different knobs and settings to select the brewing temperature and the rate at which the water pours through the filter. So they can press a button and then they can walk away and ring up another customer at the cashier or get a pastry or chat with customers and then come back to the machine when it's done making the pour over.
Wow. I get the sense that baristas are sort of shaking their heads in disapproval that no machine can replicate what they do.
There certainly are some that are a bit worried about this and whether automation is going to one day replace them. You know, some that I've talked to are actually in favor of it because they feel like it allows them to concentrate on other things like educating consumers about coffee and that they don't have to be hunched over, pouring over a cup of coffee for 5 minutes at a time and potentially getting things wrong. Because apparently there's a lot of variation from one pour to the next, from one barista to the next, and sometimes there have been complaints about the quality of the pour over not always being the same. So in some ways, it's a little bit liberating. In some ways, I think it's a bit worrying to baristas.
Thanks, Julie. Wall Street Journal reporter Julie Jargon. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Glad you could spend some time with us with a deep freeze gripping much of the country and winter still fairly young. Here's a look at things you should not leave in your car when it's this cold. Number one, cell phones. Apple advises against operating devices at temperatures lower than 32 degrees. Lithium-ion batteries can stop working in extreme cold. Number two, soda or beer. Water, of course, expands when it freezes, and for canned liquids under pressure, that can mean explosion. The freeze temperature for Coca-Cola, for example, is 30 degrees. For beer, it's 27 degrees. Number three on the list, musical instruments. Things contract when they freeze, so this can cause some instruments to go out of tune. If your instrument is made of real wood, for example, the cold air can cause cracking. Number four, eggs. Freezing causes the yolk to become thick and syrupy. Number five, canned foods. Letting a can of beans freeze allows for the water to freeze and expand in a similar way to beer and soda. Number six, medication. Drugs like insulin can lose their effectiveness. Number seven, of course, loved ones like kids and pets. And number eight, a low gas tank. Keeping a fuel tank more than half full helps to prevent fuel lines from freezing. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. As a business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.